From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Dry January may be months behind us, but Natasha David, the proprietor of beloved New York City bar Nightcap, which closed in the fall of 2020, is here to discuss her new book of cocktails called Drink Lightly. It's for anyone who's looking for a lightweight cocktail or an adult beverage without any alcohol. Hi, Natasha.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm so happy that you're here with us.
So happy to be here.
You know, it's interesting. I think over the past couple of years, many people at home have had their relationship to alcohol strained a bit, in the sense that that moment that many of us really relish of having a perfectly made cocktail set down in front of us in the perfect glass, well, that joy may have been lost in a quest to simply alter ourselves, the nadir of which might be putting a spigot of box wine directly into your mouth. But you're all about the joy of that moment. Can you share that with us and what your aim is when going about creating lower alcohol cocktails?
Yeah, absolutely. I've always loved this style of drinking. I've never been one to enjoy getting drunk. So I've always sort of reached for the lower alcohol things, or had a glass of wine instead of the shot of whiskey at the end of my shifts. To me, sharing a drink, like sharing a meal, really, is about being with other people. And I feel like I can experience that personally in a more joyful way if I just sort of have, you know, like a little happy buzz. I'm so glad that you mentioned the sort of state of the world and everyone's sort of relationship to alcohol during this time, because, you know, I started writing this book right before COVID hit, and then COVID happened and I had to shut down my bar. The only way to describe that is sort of the emotional turmoil of having to shut down your own business while you sort of feel like the world is falling apart around you. I lost a lot of that joy, right? And I had a really hard time writing these recipes, and thankfully had a publisher and an editor who was very sympathetic to that and also understood that the process requires a certain mindset, right? And really the way that I found my way back to the creative place to come up with these recipes and find that joy again was community and the sort of support I felt from obviously the bar world, but customers and my family is what really helped me sort of crawl out of that dark space that we all felt, where we were maybe all having a few too many martinis and a few too many, you know, boxes of wine, to return to this with sort of a fresher outlook and I think sort of a more focused and more purposeful vision.
You are known to be a master of the spritz at your former bar Nightcap. You always had several seasonal versions going and did over 60 different versions over the years.
Yeah.
Why the spritz? What's your emotional connection to it?
Well, the spritz is, to me, a very personal drink because it's a drink that my mother drinks, and it's a drink that I've seen my mother drink my whole life. And it's a drink she still drinks now, and her white wine spritz has a very, very, very generous slug of seltzer, and it's much more bubbly water than it is wine, which probably also sort of influenced my sort of outlook on drinking. Oh, of course, there's the Aperol spritz, and we all love and adore it, but I think the sort of wine spritz has always had this, you know, terrible reputation, and it's actually a really fantastic drink to enjoy, so you could say I sort of feel like I'm on a mission to give it a better place in the world.
A big part of having some of your drinks be lower alcohol is dilution and a nice pour of something very low alcohol or just water. Could you give us an example of something delicious that might be on the bubbly, the spritzy side?
Yeah, spritzy, bubbly side. The drink that I sort of talk about in the book quite a bit, it's called the Pinkies Out. It was a drink that I came up with for actually the first menu at Nightcap 8 years ago. And it really was an homage to my mom's white wine spritz. But I used orange wine instead to kind of give it a little bit more of a dynamic flavor profile. And there's a little bit of verjus in there to kind of brighten it up. And then instead of sort of the classic bubbly wine or bubbly seltzer, I top it with sparkling apple cider. And that really is a formula that I love to use, right? It's just a little bit of some wine, a little bit of flavor from something else, and then some kind of bubble. And it's such an easy formula that you can open your fridge and there's always something that you can throw together and make it delicious.
Can you tell us about the Giggle Fit? I feel like it's such a great way of understanding how you're building these drinks. And it's also fascinating the different types of flavors that you're combining.
My whole sort of thing is that the base spirit in all of the drinks in this book, if they do use alcohol, are low proof. And if I use something that is a full proof spirit, then I'm using it in a smaller quantity, right? So I'm not raising the ABV too much. The full proof spirits are really sort of like supporting characters, right? And the lower proof spirits, which are usually the supporting characters, are the stars. And then the other big thing about the drinks in this recipe is that they really are all based on classic cocktails. So in this drink, we've got Lillet Rosé as our base. We've got a little bit of aquavit. You've got lemon juice. You've got some pomegranate grenadine, a tiny bit of honey, a tiny bit of carrot eau de vie, and then some sparkling rosé. And the inspiration for this drink is a French 75, which is the sort of classic recipe is some gin or some cognac, some lemon juice, some simple syrup, and some sparkling wine. So Lillet Rosé has all these sort of beautiful tart strawberry notes that are so wonderful. The aquavit is really just to kind of bring out more of those savory notes. And it's also what I like to describe as a disruptor. It kind of makes you think a little bit deeper. It could be sort of this easy drink on paper, but that little like wrinkle that I'm throwing in, hopefully it's more of a journey.
Okay, so you said the words carrot eau de vie, kind of like a throwaway. We need to know more about that.
Yeah, right? It's made by an incredible producer called Hans Reisetbauer, who has an incredible array of eau de vies and some very unusual flavors, such as hazelnut. He also does the standard pear and raspberry, but, you know, this does them so, so well. He makes a brandy out of carrots, and it is pure magic, and it's highly expensive because the amount of carrots and the process that goes into it, when you taste it, you really feel like you are tasting a carrot.
It really strikes me that so much of how you put these drinks together is exactly like how I cook. When you're really familiar with your palate and your mise en place and the kind of pantry you have, you think nothing about pulling from here and there and adding a little bit of this and a little bit of that. But when we do that with drinks, it can get expensive very quickly. So if we want to give ourselves the gift of enlarging our spirits pantry, but we have a budget, are there one or two types that we would find used more than once in this book that you think would give us a really great reward?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I would like to very much acknowledge that low proof spirits, you know, they're also a little bit harder to find because they're not quite as popular, right? But to that, I will also say that liquor stores are happy to order you things. Something that's really interesting that is great to use is Flock de Gascon, which is a delicious fortified wine. A Lillet is something that's, I would say, quite easy to probably purchase and is very versatile. I have a little section at the end of each chapter that I call Easy Peasy 1-2-3, which is literally just highballs or drinks that you can throw together that feel very complete but are just comprised of two ingredients and a garnish.
So give us an example of one of those.
Well, one of the examples for an Easy Peasy, one of my absolute favorite ingredients is souze. A really wonderful way to enjoy it is I recommend souze and some tonic, and specifically like an elderflower tonic makes it even more delicious. You just throw it together whenever, and you've used that bottle then hopefully more than two times.
Well, thank you so much, Natasha. It's really a unique book.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Natasha David is the author of Drink Lightly. a lighter take on serious cocktails, which is more than 100 recipes for low and no alcohol drinks. You can find one of them on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, food delivery apps. Restaurants can't live with them, but they also can't live without them.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. During the pandemic, food delivery apps became the primary way many people ate out. And that doesn't look like it's going to change anytime soon. While takeout and delivery have been a lifeline for some restaurants, it's not all wine and roses. Third-party delivery apps have plenty of downsides. Sure, they are so convenient for the customers, for the eaters. But are tech companies thriving at the expense of small businesses? Lauren Lemos co-owns Wax Paper, a deli known for making sandwiches named after public radio personalities, including this one. Over the past year, they were one of Caviar's top sellers. She joins us to talk about her experience with third-party delivery apps. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me as a sandwich.
Absolutely. You're a bestseller as well. It's true.
With third-party food delivery apps like Uber Eats, DoorDash, Caviar, Postmates, and Grubhub, you and a lot of other restaurant owners have talked a lot about how you can't live with them, you can't live without them. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's very true. Well, it's a wide topic, but I'll try my best here. Phone orders are pure chaos. So to take phone orders, you experience a lot of things like telemarketers, people calling and canceling, not showing up, changing something on their order. Maybe you miss a call on call waiting. You can't really service your customers to the fullest unless you have a dedicated person answering the phones, nor can you really offer delivery unless you have a great insurance plan and you don't have a brain like mine where I worry about all of my friends and family and coworkers driving around. So you kind of reach an impasse where you have to sign up for these apps because they allow you to take orders online and sort of cut out that middle chaos. And so what happens is it works for a long time and it's convenient for the customer. It's convenient for us. And then you start to look at your profit and loss and you realize it's not working so well for you. So you start to try to negotiate the terms, prices, commissions, and that's where it gets really sticky and weird.
Yeah, you know, I remember when I had my place, we actually did our own delivery in-house, and we did have a separate person, and we had our own people making the deliveries. And when apps just started at the very beginning, I remember thinking, like, I'm paying 30% to these people when I just make a profit of 10%.
Yeah, it's pretty wild when you think about it in a very simple form. 30% on a $100 order, that's $30. $30 could be a couple dishes. It could be really a check, a whole meal. And it begs the question of how is something that is done over the internet, something so simple, something you pick up, you know, you open an app, you order something, boom, it's done. How does that warrant such high service fees to the customer and the restaurant? Where does that money go? It's hard to accept that when you read the news and you learn that this is a company that's valued at $1 billion and did really well during the pandemic and sold their shares for more than they had offered and et cetera. I think it's really complex. I think that obviously it is a business like ours where it has employees and people that need to be paid, but there's just a lot of big question marks.
So which delivery apps does Wax Paper currently work with?
So we are exclusive to DoorDash, Caviar, And what I mean by that is we originally signed up with Caviar about 5 years ago. But over the pandemic, DoorDash bought Caviar. They had two entirely different customer bases, and they didn't want to lose customers, so they kept the platform names separate. However, the companies are DoorDash. So we're on Caviar and DoorDash.
Are the issues with each of them the same? Did you ever feel like you preferred to work with one rather than another, and why?
In the beginning, when we signed up with Caviar, it was small local places. You couldn't find McDonald's on there. You couldn't find large restaurants. It was your local favorites. The platform itself was managed like a restaurant. It was sold as that too. The people that work with us have worked in restaurants, et cetera. These are the staff working for Caviar. We had a general manager. We had great fast phone support aside from commission. It was a great service to work with. The issues really started happening when DoorDash bought Caviar. That buyout occurred right when the pandemic started. So we started working with a new app, a new platform. We had no training. We couldn't have people in-house to train us because we were in a pandemic. And it just sort of crumbled from there. To say that I don't like to work with either of them right now would be wrong, because I am a partner of theirs. That's what they call their customers, partners. But there is a big conversation to be had for sure.
You recently posted on Instagram about Caviar running promos that made the price of your sandwiches, if people bought them on the app, lower than if they bought sandwiches directly from Wax Paper, which in a way is sort of like competing with you.
Absolutely.
Tell us how it works and how these promotions impact small businesses.
It's important to mention that everyone enjoys a discount. Everyone enjoys a competitive price, right? In my past, working with these services, promotions were rolled out with prior notice. Hey, this is how it's going to work. This is who's going to pay for it, et cetera, et cetera. This particular promotion happened to come at a very interesting time, which when I started talking to our representatives about peeling back from the service, and this promo was not run by me as a partner. I was working the register, and all of a sudden we just get a blast of Caviar tickets, and I noticed this promotion, and it's called Sandwich Promo. And it just really bothered me because it was very obviously targeted at our product. And I noticed that it gave the customer $3.50 off one of our sandwiches. And at the bottom of the receipt, it said, "This is a promotion paid for fully by Caviar at no cost to you." That message was to us, the restaurant. But that's simply not true, because we pay commission on that order. So there is a cost to us. And that sort of lit a fire in me. And I'm no stranger to impulsive honesty and posting and being transparent with our customers. And this was just kind of enough is enough.
I just feel like people are being held hostage.
Yeah, it's like a bad relationship.
We should talk about your Instagram post, which you acknowledged how difficult it is to talk about things publicly. And you said that customers want delicious food at reasonable prices delivered in a timely manner, and they don't necessarily want to look behind the curtain and see all the issues that go into preparing and serving that food. Were customers supportive of you?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, incredibly. I did have a few people asking questions that were challenging, breaking that fourth wall and sort of showing you the ugly of what happens behind the scenes is something that I experiment with a lot. And I'm just not shy about, because I feel like hospitality and food, it really is a staged play. You know, it really is a performance. Every single day we go out, we're giving you a unique performance of what we have to offer. And we're doing it to the best of our abilities. And we want you to enjoy yourselves. But taking my business owner hat off, having food made for you and delivered directly to your door, you don't have to leave your computer, you don't have to leave your kids. This is a whole new luxury in addition to going out to eat. And it comes at a cost. And the question is right now, who absorbs this cost? Who is responsible for this cost? I had a lot of customer support, and we constantly have customers saying, what is the best way to directly support you?
Have you ever tried having just a dedicated person to do nothing but take phone orders?
We haven't tried that. We're such a small business. I've crunched the numbers. I just can't really see how it just didn't really seem to make much sense for us.
Have you had any other issues with third-party delivery apps, like fraud or tech glitches or even safety concerns?
Yeah, absolutely. When we first opened and we were taking phone orders, we would have Postmates or Grubhub drivers come in to place orders. And I was really confused because we hadn't signed up with any of these services. And they would show me their phone and there would be a wax paper order on there. Well, sure enough, I'd jump on and see our menu on Postmates or Grubhub. It wasn't an approved menu. Prices were wrong. Descriptions were wrong. Important allergy information was wrong. And in order to get off of those platforms that were more or less profiting off of our menu when we hadn't signed any contracts with them, I had to email cease and desist. It was just crazy. And I had to do that every single year because they would do that every year. Safety issues, absolutely. We've had drivers who are very angry that they're there early for their pickup order and they have to wait. We have had many choice words thrown our way.
So several cities, including LA, San Francisco, and New York, capped commissions and credit card fees that third-party delivery apps can charge restaurants. Did this make things better? Is it going to go away? Is this just temporary?
Yes and no. I mean, taking our commission down because it was mandated by the city at one point, of course, we were grateful for. Did we see that as like a nice gesture from the platform that we work with? No, we saw it as you have to do this, so you got to do it. What ended up happening was when the rates went back up, we weren't informed. So it was just sort of really never discussed where our rates were at. It was helpful for some time. When it came back, it was just sort of like, okay, here we go again. It throws your P&Ls off. It throws your margins off. It throws everything off.
What's the way forward for restaurants and delivery apps? Do you think the dynamic can get better, or is this delivery model just fundamentally broken?
Gosh, I really don't know. For us, they are invaluable, but in order to remain as a business for themselves and for restaurants to remain in business, there has to be hard, hard negotiation. There has to be a lowering of rates. So until those commission rates come down, or the app performs at 100%, I don't know. I don't see a great future ahead, no.
So for fans of Wax Paper who are listening to this and whose really hearts are going out to you, what is the best way for us to support you?
Well, first of all, thank you. We appreciate you. However you come to order our food, you're supporting us. So we don't want you to feel guilty if you find us on an app and you order us. What I do as a diner is I check the website of the restaurant first, see if they have online ordering, and I order through there. If it's out of the radius and they direct me to Caviar or DoorDash, then that's the route that I go to get them, or I order and go pick up. The number one way you can support a restaurant is order ahead and pick up.
And I just want to say that I personally, Evan Kleiman of The Sandwich, have never used one of those delivery apps to get my food, not even during the pandemic.
Amazing. That's incredible.
Well, I'm a restaurant owner. I'm a former restaurant owner who knows what that cost is. It's gutting. To get my groceries, I'll do it. But to buy from an independent restaurant, I'll order through their website and pick up. And the people who do take phone orders, smaller businesses, I talk to them on the phone because I'm just, you know, old like that.
I absolutely think that is incredible. I think you are you're a rarity, really. You're in probably a very small group of people who, you know, take that time and care to understand the other side of it. And that when we talk about supporting small businesses, this is definitely in the conversation now.
Well, as I said before, Lauren, my heart goes out to you and all the restaurant owners who are dealing with this situation. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Evan. It was such a pleasure to talk to you.
Lauren Lemos is the co-owner of Wax Paper. You can order sandwiches directly from their website and pick them up Tuesday through Saturday at either of their shops in the Chinatown and Frogtown neighborhoods of Los Angeles. Often when a book arrives, I immediately page through it to gaze at the photographs before I read the intro or the recipes. But when Mexican Food, the Ultimate Cookbook, showed up, what struck me was the list of collaborators. It's unusual to see 8 names on a book that offers such a cohesive look into a cuisine. Writer Vanessa Cesena dives into that collaboration and talks Mexican culinary history.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. This book is great. It's huge. Tell me how this collaborative cookbook came to be.
Yeah, it is huge. 300 recipes, around 800 pages or so. The photographer, Jim Sullivan, a good friend of mine, he's actually the one that reached out to each one of us individually. We all knew him. I think what really added value is that some of us are from Southern California, but we all really had roots in Mexico. So our family, our ancestors are from Mexico.
Were people assigned certain dishes, or did people just naturally fall into different kind of interests that allowed the combination of everyone involved to create a cohesive book?
No, each chef just went ahead and put together recipes that meant something to them, that were tied to their family's history or where they grew up. We just let them kind of run with their creative juices and really channel that history and that love for the cuisine into their recipes.
Some cookbooks strive to sort of document a very traditional approach to regional cuisines. Other cookbooks that are chef-driven often have their roots in personal identity and technique and sort of portray a more modern look at a cuisine. Where do you think this collection of recipes sits within that?
I would say it's a combination of it. As you look through the recipes, you'll definitely see more traditional dishes, traditional in the sense of the dishes that a lot of us think about when we think about Mexican food. Then we also had a variety of street food recipes, right? We had the tacos, the tortas ahogadas, etc. And then we had some chefs that had a different type of training, right? They spent some time in Noma, have worked in the Yucatan. I'm thinking Chef Balo Orozco and Chef Jose Luis Inostroza, who really incorporate different elements of traditional cooking techniques that are indigenous to the Yucatan. And then they also incorporate a lot of fermentation and those other styles that really make their recipes and their approach to traditional cuisine more playful and just very interesting.
We should name check other people involved. Mm-hmm. Luis Robles, Agui Salcedo, yes. Mm-hmm. Aaron Melendrez, mm-hmm. and then Lori Sauer, who seems to have taken on the dessert chapter. And then what was your role?
So I was brought on as a writer, and I essentially focused on talking about the history of the cuisine with a little bit more of an overview on the regional differences of Mexican food.
Let's talk about the beginnings of Mexican food. Mexico has such a long history of colonization, but let's start with the role of indigenous ingredients and techniques. What are some of them, and what dishes do we still see today that show very clearly indigenous roots?
The first thing that comes up, I think, for many people is the use of maíz, right? Obviously in tortillas and tostadas, empanadas, just in a lot of different foods that we have. Traditionally, maíz is prepared through the nixtamal process. Even the simple charring of chiles, for example, there is one condiment called the recado negro, which is a very interesting process. It's the burning of all of these chilies and other spices and charring them until they're black. That process brings that very bitter, very smoky flavor to this paste, to this recado negro.
I really should have had lunch before talking to you.
I know, me too.
This book is huge, 300 recipes. But I think that salsas are one way of looking at and celebrating the amazing variety in Mexican cuisine. So let's start with Siquilpac from the Yucatan.
Yes, Siquilpac. It's definitely a salsa that could be more eaten as a side dish, actually. It isn't very common outside of the Yucatan. So it's very similar to a hummus. It's mainly used with pepitas and with tomatoes, onions, garlic. It has some spice from the habanero chiles. It has some acidity and some sweetness from lime juice and orange juice. And essentially, all of these ingredients are charred or they're grilled on a cast iron skillet or on a comal. And then they are all blended together in a food processor until the mixture turns into a paste. Again, almost like a hummus. And you can eat that with totopos, with tortilla chips, or even spread them on tostadas. And it makes a very nice snack.
So you have such detailed, intimate knowledge with this book. Choose a recipe that you really loved that you hope people will make at home.
One of my favorites, just I think a staple in Mexico, I would go with the carnitas, which isn't something that people haven't been exposed to, but I think it's a dish that many times we don't think that we can make at home. And the reason why also I want to encourage people to make this is because it's such a very beautiful process and a connection with the protein, with pork. It gives the cook, right, or the family, if you're going to cook this with your family, a chance to really appreciate how to use all parts of the pork. That's also a beauty of Mexican cuisine, is that we don't disregard all parts of the animal, right, or the different parts of the produce or whatnot. And so this process of being able to see how something like the skin, right, or the ugly bits of the pork really transform after being slowly braised into this really soft, delicious, aromatic meat that's falling off of the bones that you can eat with freshly made tortillas, preferably corn tortillas. And then you can top it with one of the many salsas. You can top it with pickled onions or pickled manzano peppers. All of those are also found in the book. And it's just a very comforting dish.
Well, thank you so much, Vanessa. The book is really something that one could turn to over and over again. A very interesting collaboration. And we should thank photographer Jim Sullivan for bringing everybody together.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
That was Vanessa Cesena, collaborator and writer of Mexican Food, The Ultimate Cookbook. Head to our website, kcrw.com/goodfood, to get a recipe from the book. In a minute, when is halloumi not halloumi? That's next when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Have you seen the meme, "It's only Frankenstein if it's made in the Frankenstein region of France. Otherwise, it's a sparkling monster"? Provenance is everything in the food world, and regional pride is closely linked to that word, authenticity. International journalist Soraya Kishtwari was in Westminster, England, innocently reporting on halloumi, a salty, rubbery, grillable cheese, when she found herself in the middle of a story filled with geopolitics and diplomacy.
Hi, Evan. Thanks very much for having me.
We're excited to have you. Tell me what the situation was that put you right in the middle.
I was speaking to one of my contacts who was a government minister, a member of parliament, and he told me about one of his constituents. He was very proud to have been able to have helped him secure funding for his halloumi venture. Except what I thought was a good news story turned out to be anything but, because this particular individual didn't want his halloumi venture to be found out.
What do you mean by that?
He had lobbied his member of parliament for help in terms of securing European Union funding. However, he hadn't gone through all the usual protocol, the steps necessary to apply for being able to do so, because it actually is a product that has a trademark. It did it at that particular time. And so he was doing this slightly on the sly, we could say.
So in other words, as a UK cheesemaker, he could make this cheese, but he couldn't call it halloumi.
Technically, you are not supposed to, and you weren't supposed to back then unless you requested permission to do so.
Where is the protected designation of origin for halloumi?
On Cyprus, the legendary home of Aphrodite in the Mediterranean Sea. It's an island nation. It's technically split in two. So you have northern Cyprus inhabited by Turkish Cypriots, and you have southern Cyprus inhabited by Greek Cypriots. And of course, Greek Cypriots belong to the European Union. Their part of the island does since 2004.
Very complicated.
It is complicated. It's created something of a diplomatic row in so many different areas, whether it's between the Turkish Cypriots and the Greek Cypriots, whether it's between the different types of dairy producers on the island, so cattle or sheep or goats. And then, of course, in terms of other nations who are wanting other farmers elsewhere outside of Cyprus who want to make their own halloumi.
For a cheese to be considered halloumi on Cyprus, does it have to use certain percentages of specific types of milk?
Well, it didn't in the past. Cyprus itself has been wrangled in a long, drawn-out process with the European Commission, which is the body that designates PDO status, protected designation of origin status. And when I say a long, drawn-out process, it's taken several attempts, and the last attempt finally succeeded, and I say succeeded in inverted commas, because not everyone is happy. As of 2024, so we've still got another couple of years to go, in order to be able to call your cheese halloumi, even if it's made in Cyprus, it has to have 51% either sheep or goat's milk, or a mixture of the two. If it's a majority cow's milk, then you cannot call it halloumi. And therein lies part of the problem.
How much halloumi is exported from Cyprus?
Today, globally, the market value of halloumi is something like $500 million, so $500 million worldwide. And I believe the American market is increasing every day.
Who's the largest importer now?
It's been the UK for the longest time. Outside of Cyprus, it's been the UK. And in fact, because of COVID, Cyprus had something like 6,000 tons of halloumi that it had to keep in deep freeze storage facilities. I'd love to know where they are, because I wouldn't mind getting hold of some myself.
Yeah, you know, I'm such a suggestible eater that in preparation for doing this interview, I actually had some last night. I love it. It's like the perfect amount of saltiness, and the squeakiness is just so appealing.
I love how it feels like a real meat replacement. It's just so filling, filling and fulfilling in many ways. Do you know if the one you had, where it was produced?
It was produced in Cyprus. I try to always buy the PDO if I see that that's an option. How do you like to use it best?
Grilled. It has a high heat resistance, and so it doesn't melt, and yet you can sort of It turns golden while you're grilling it. I love the texture and how satisfying it is. And I tend to enjoy it a lot as an accompaniment to aubergines, eggplant, and grilled peppers.
Yeah, I mean, last night when I made it, actually, I was making a version of sag paneer, but I didn't have any paneer, so I used the halloumi instead. It was really delicious.
That worked out well.
Well, thank you so much, Soraya.
You are more than welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
That's Soraya Kishtwari. Find a link to her whetstone story, The Halloumi Conundrum, on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. When Chef Uwen Le opened Bea U in LA's Virgil Village, she had a simple goal: pay her workers a living wage without accelerating gentrification in her neighborhood. That is not always a given in the restaurant world. In fact, it's shockingly uncommon. But Le had a background in urban planning and workers' rights. While it hasn't been easy, she has managed to build a business founded on equity and sustainability while honoring the Vietnamese food she grew up eating. Bea U is the subject of this week's In the Weeds.
My name's Uyen Le, and I am the chef owner of Bea U, which serves Vietnamese street food and comfort food. Bea U is a restaurant that has three main goals: to serve fresh and flavorful food at prices affordable in a rent-controlled neighborhood, and to create good working conditions and professional development opportunities. Food was the topic of our breakfast conversation, and while we were eating lunch and while we were eating dinner, we would talk about more food. It was also a source of comfort. We also try to sit down together and eat as many meals as possible. So I think food and family really come hand in hand. Two almost felt like the same thing. I come from a background with probably 15, 20 years doing community organizing, also working in the Vietnamese American community, specifically after Hurricane Katrina, on rebuilding, but also community empowerment. And then after that, I went to city planning school and I worked in the labor rights and economic justice movements in Los Angeles before quitting those endeavors and going back to culinary school and then working in kitchens for a few years before opening up my own restaurant. I've always been really attracted to food, but also the business of food and the folks who work in the restaurant industry. I think it's an area that's so pervasive that we interact with folks all the time because people have to eat several times a day and they make choices about what they put into their own bodies and then also where they spend their money. And I still wanted to continue with my lifelong pursuit of social and economic justice and equity and access, but I wanted to have kind of a small enough venue, so to speak, in order to meet some of these values that I had, that I was kind of working on these large kind of billion-dollar funds, but I wanted something that I can really kind of put my arms around and try to bring my values, even if it's small, that I felt like it was something that could really be something that I can work with and grow. I think restaurants have a large role to play in reimagining sustainability and workers' rights because workers have so low visibility, especially back-of-house workers in restaurants, and yet folks are eating out so often, and even when they're getting takeout, that, you know, there are all these kind of hands that touch the food before they do. And I just think that it's something that so many people interact with daily, and that there's so many opportunities for how we can grow this industry and create more sustainable opportunities in this industry, but also increase understanding of the consuming public because I think a lot of folks do take food very personally. And I think it's an entry point to talk about issues like workers' rights and sustainability that seem more accessible to consumers. To be honest, I'm still trying to find the balance between what affordability means for guests and then having livable wages for my team, especially when the food itself is so prep heavy to meet my other goal, which is to have fresh and flavorful food that we basically make from scratch. And so I don't think that I have some key to this three goals yet that I'm trying to achieve, but I'm working on it. And I think to come in to a business with these values and not prioritize necessarily one over the other two is really what I'm trying to do. But the next steps really are trying to calibrate these different things and then finding, you know, more efficiencies on how the staff operates, trying to find a better workflow, and then also trying to define what affordability means. Is it every item on the menu? Is it certain items? Is it trying to find some sliding scale charges that I can create so that folks who can afford more do pay more? So I'm still trying to work these things out. We're just a little over a year old, and so can't say I have any types of solutions right now, but those are the values that I'm going to continue to have and bring to the business. When people say that they can find something cheaper in Little Saigon or San Gabriel Valley, my response is that, yes, you absolutely can, but it won't be the version that we have. And I think that there's a lot to be said about what quality means, and then also that not just the quality of the food itself and that the care that goes into it, but the quality of the service, and then also what other types of positive impacts come from investing basically with your money on where you spend it as a consumer. But really, you know, I just tell people, yes, you're right. You can find a banh mi cheaper in San Gabriel Valley or Orange County, but it won't be our version. Vietnamese food representation, I think, a lot of times has been sort of distilled down to pho dishes, you know, like the beef noodle soup, but that just one specific type of noodle soup. And Vietnam's such a large country with so many different regions, you know, 1,700 miles of coastline, that I think there are so many dishes that don't necessarily get the popular attention or isn't, you know, that first dish that somebody thinks of. And also at the same time, I think there's a reason I don't call my food traditional and I don't call it authentic, because I feel like food always evolves and food in Vietnam is evolving. It's not some sort of thing that you put in a museum. And because Vietnamese food to me really means fresh, full of flavor, with a lot of contrast and textures, with a lot of care that's put into kind of layering different flavors and different textures together in a specific way, that I think it has so much to offer. This is my first restaurant that I've ever owned and been a chef of. I think calling Beu a model right now, quite honestly, would just be a bit premature. I'm still just every day, this is the name of this show, like in the weeds, trying to figure stuff out. If somebody's to come to the restaurant this weekend, I'd recommend definitely the braised pork belly and eggs dish. It really is a dish that's very comforting. You can taste these different items in there whose textures have changed, and it's just transformed into something different by spending time with each other. I'd also probably tell someone to get the banh mi sandwich, even the vegan one. I've spent a lot of time coming up with the vegan pate recipe that I feel like can stand up to the bread. The customer favorites a lot of times really is the popcorn chicken with the fried curry leaves, and then our summer rolls, which
of different kinds. The one that I created for the menu is also vegan in that it has avocado on the inside and then seared oyster mushrooms just right on the outside, but still encased in a thin piece of rice paper. And I wanted to do a vegan version that would create some new excitement about the possibilities of what you can wrap in rice paper.
That was Uyen Le, chef and owner of Bea U on Hoover Street near Clinton in the area between Silver Lake and East Hollywood. Up next, we catch up with Chef David Tanis at the Farmers Market. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Now let's head to the Farmers Market, where Ben Mims has an update on what's in season this week in Southern California.
This is Ben Mims with the Market Report. I'm here in Santa Monica with David Tanis, chef partner at Lulu Restaurant in Westwood. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Ben.
So, David, we are smack in the middle of spring. There's so many, like, wonderful green things in abundance here. What is that like for you, for how you cook and how you source at Lulu?
Oh, it's super exciting. I've been waiting for this moment. It's nice to cook all the winter stuff, but when the little green things start happening, it's really exciting.
Absolutely. And so what are all the little green things that you're looking for at the market right now?
Anything fresh, green, sprouty, herby, lovely. But asparagus is beginning, and that's the nice thing. And papa beans are starting too, and the new garlic is happening. Those three things right there just make me want to jump for joy.
Talk to me about asparagus. I feel like a lot of people think that's a pretty common vegetable, but what particularly about asparagus in the spring is so special for you?
I'm a kind of asparagus fanatic, so I'm not the kind of person who would eat asparagus from Peru in the middle of December. Spring is the time for asparagus, and when it starts coming up, it's super, super exciting. We don't see it when I lived on the East Coast. We didn't see asparagus in New York till almost June. You know, it's all about the various climates. The thing is, freshness is everything with asparagus. So if you can go to the farmer's market and get asparagus there, you know it's just been picked. Whereas asparagus that you find in the supermarket certainly has days and days on it, and maybe even longer than that, you know, with cold storage and whatnot. You need to look at the bottom of the stalks, because if it looks freshly cut, that's a good sign. You don't want anything that looks brown or soggy. And you want the stalks to be really smooth and shiny. And you want the tips to be tight. Like, for instance, this is some asparagus that got picked a little bit later, and you can see that they let it go just a little too long, so it's starting almost to go to flower at the top, which isn't a terrible thing, but when the buds are still tight, that's when it's the best.
Does that change the flavor when it starts to flower like that?
It starts to get more grassy, right? But if you're buying asparagus right now, you're pretty much guaranteed to have really nice fresh stuff.
So what are some tips that you can give people for how to cook asparagus at home? Like, what are your kind of favorite ways to do it simply at home?
I'm not opposed to boiled water. I'm not talking about a great big vat of boiling water, but dropping asparagus into, you know, 2 or 3 inches of boiling water that's well salted and making sure to pull them out in time is really a nice way to go, especially with new asparagus, because you really want to be able to taste it later in the season. When you start to get bored with asparagus, then it's time to grill or roast or that sort of thing. But steaming and boiling, I think, is really a good way to go. You have to also account for the fact that the heat is going to carry over for a few minutes after you pull it from the pot. So you need to pull it kind of like spaghetti. You have to pull it a few minutes before you think it's done. And then you can eat it with anything, you know, just salt and good olive oil is a great way. But or a vinaigrette, or a little homemade mayonnaise, or any number of things. Traditionally in Europe, you eat asparagus with your fingers, and I recommend that.
How are you planning to cook the asparagus at Lulu? Any kind of like dish that you can tell us about you're working on?
We've been doing some lamb braises, some little lamb stew, so spring lamb stew. But you would have little fresh spring vegetables assembled along with the lamb in the braise, and you would cook them at the last minute so that when it gets to the table, you have this kind of beautiful bouquet of spring vegetables. It would be like tiny little turnips with their greens, little florets of this gorgeous yellow cauliflower that we've been seeing. Asparagus just cut into short lengths, maybe 1-inch lengths. And fava beans are coming in right now too. So when you see all of those together, and they're all just about sweetness too.
That sounds wonderful. Thank you so much, David.
You're so welcome.
That was David Tanis, chef partner at Lulu Restaurant in Westwood. I'm here with Roberto Hernandez from Suncoast Farms. Good morning, Roberto.
Good morning.
So, Roberto, we just spoke with David Tanis about asparagus and how he's using it in his restaurant. Can you tell us a little bit about the asparagus you grow and kind of, for people who may not know, how does asparagus grow?
The asparagus that we have at the moment, we planted it 2 years ago. Last year was a little struggling time for us because we weren't able to use a new harvest because you gotta wait 2 years no matter what. We cut about a month or maybe 3 weeks just to help the root get stronger, but you do gotta wait 2 years. And then now this is the year, but we have a hiccup with the frost that we've been having the last, I want to say 3 to 6 weeks. That was unexpected, and it's putting us back a little bit because everybody wants the asparagus so desperately, and it's coming more and more, but very slow. The slowest growing method, it's right now.
How does that affect the flavor or tenderness of the asparagus? Does it at all?
Well, if it grows longer than this, they would get woody. And if one overgrows, then that one is just toss it and don't concentrate on the long ones.
Right now, because it's springtime and asparagus is in season, how much are you harvesting a day?
Saturday, we did 9 boxes and we put in 60 bunches on each box. For yesterday, we probably ended up with like 13 boxes yesterday. We are getting more week by week.
Do you like to eat it? How do you like to prepare for yourself?
I saute it. Saute it with a little grapeseed oil, a little bit of lemon pepper. It's so quick, so delicious. And also you can just steam. You don't have to do anything, and it's very healthy that way. The thicker ones would be good for the grill if you want to do that. Any way you want to eat it, but the more common way is steam.
That sounds delicious. Thank you so much, Roberto.
You're welcome.
That was Roberto Hernandez with Suncoast Farms. For the Market Report, I'm Ben Mims.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can always subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Julian Ferguson, Elena Shatkin, Laurel Garcia, Tyler Boudreau, Ben Mims, Kenny Ng, Desmond Taylor, and Nick Lamponi. And special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. For a low-key end-of-day drink, especially in the heat, I'll go for a light gin and tonic made with a super dry London Dry gin and maybe just a splash of Campari. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food.